Welcome to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. We are here at Easy Street Restaurant, Bar, and Performance Hall. Hey, I got it right.
There you go.
That's like the first time in months I've gotten that right. And I am Scott Wright, and I am a mediocre journalist.
I'm Kelly Turner. I'm not a doctor.
I'm Katie Givens, and I am not a lawyer.
What are we talking about today? I forgot.
True crime.
Oh, yeah, true crime. All right, well, that's easy enough. We're going to talk about actually something that happened in May of 2005.
Yep.
And just to stick with the same vein of crime that we've been doing since we started this podcast, true crime with an Alabama connection today, Kelly.
I got this. Yeah, I'm ready today. All right, so the following is a story no one should have to tell about the nightmare no one wants to live, told by the parent no one wants to be. But what happened to Natalie Holloway and the circumstances following her disappearance on the last night of her senior trip to Aruba is the story everyone needs to hear. And that is an excerpt from the book that I used to research this case, which is called Loving Natalie, and it's by Beth Holloway, Natalie's mom.
That's her mother, right? And her father also wrote a book that I read part of in preparation for this podcast. And I found another one called The Holloway Files. And it was an investigative book that a couple of guys who were Danish, would it be, if it's the Netherlands, they're Danish, right? Because,
sure.
Because Aruba is a protectorate of the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And so, not to get too far ahead of the story, but eventually the Dutch police came in and conducted their own investigation, and that got Dutch journalists involved and interested, which they probably were from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But this book that I read, The Holloway Files, is a book by a couple of those Danish journalists who got down into the weeds on this story. But I'll let you talk.
You're right. There was a lot of journalists from many different places who were very interested in this case and followed it. Basically up until Hurricane Katrina hit, when that kind of changed everyone's focus in the media. But this was, if you turned on your television in 2005, particularly around after Memorial Day, you saw this.
Yeah, for
this was covered by everyone.
Hurricane Katrina hit on August the 29th of 2005. So for pretty much 3 months after Natalie Holloway went missing, that was on television, on the news networks, all day, every day.
Yes.
The confusion and the just uncertainty about what happened there. And I think we could say 16 years later, we're still there in some respects.
We're still scratching our heads and trying to figure out what happened. But let me back up and give you some background here. Natalie Holloway was born on October the 21st, 1986, in Memphis, Tennessee, to Dave and Beth Holloway. When she was three and her younger brother Matt was one, the family moved to Clinton, Mississippi. Dave and Beth divorced not long after they moved to Mississippi, and Beth was awarded sole custody of both children. About 7 years later, Beth met George Twitty, who had a nickname called Jug. And while he was on business there in Mississippi, they struck up a relationship. They began dating, and they dated about 3 years, and then in 2000, they married. Now, Jug, I'm just going to call him Jug from here on out. This is Natalie's stepfather. He had two older children that Natalie and her brother Matt adored. They moved to Mountain Brook, Alabama. So here's our Alabama tie here. Natalie was in the eighth grade when they made this move to Mountain Brook. And she quickly adapted and made friends here. She was on the dance team. She had all A's. She had a very high ACT score. Because, you know, as senior year approaches, you take that ACT and you're looking for that high grade. And not only did she have a high grade, she received a presidential scholarship to the University of Alabama, which is only given to a few and has everything to do with academics and ACT scores.
That is a full ride, I believe.
It is. So she's very driven, and her mother talks about how when Natalie would set her sights on something, she would set her goal and she was going to achieve it. I mean, she was very, very focused. So her focus was to improve by 5 points in the ACT, and she did it. And that's a pretty significant improvement.
That's a jump.
Yeah, it sure is.
That is a jump.
When you want to improve that score that much, and back in 2005, I do not believe there was a super score involved. Mm. I know now when you take the ACT, there are many schools who will super score, and not to sidetrack too much, but what they do is if you take the ACT 8 times, they'll look at all of those times and they will take your best score from each section. And that's your final score. And that's a super score. So she was very, very driven. She volunteered a lot for Habitat for Humanity, the Humane Society, the Hope Lodge, where she regularly visited children who were cancer patients. So we're making our way towards the end of our senior year. So in October of 2004, Natalie, she starts talking to her mother about this senior class trip to Aruba. And this class trip is a tradition of the Mountain Brook seniors. Many of her fellow seniors had already signed up. Several senior classes before hers had taken this trip. Natalie's older brother, George, that's one of Jug's children we talked about, he had taken this trip. And one of Jug's nephews, Thomas, was actually going to be on the trip with Natalie. I believe there was 124 students that went on this trip.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, in October, it's not time, but, you know, we got to start signing up and scheduling and begging our parents at this point to do something like that. So, Beth, she wants to give Natalie this trip because she's worked so hard, because she's earned this scholarship, because she's, you know, worked hard and done all of these things. And so Beth is wanting her to be able to experience this with her fellow classmates.
Sort of a rite of passage to take your senior trip. I mean, we won't get off into the weeds here again, but we all took a senior trip somewhere, right?
Yes.
So it's kind of a thing that everybody does.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So this is your first trip that you go on as an adult. And in quotes, as an adult, you go on this trip by yourself. No parents. You do have chaperones typically on these trips, and they did have chaperones, but they are there to pretty much do a head count every day and move on. They're not following you around.
You can't check into this resort, I'm sure, at 18.
No. That's a lot of resorts will not. Yeah. You have to have someone 25 and older typically to rent a room. They're not going to rent it to a 18-year-old. So so they were going to have these chaperones, and Beth, her mom, attended the parent meeting and was, you know, making plans for the trip. And in this meeting, a former Mountain Brook student attended, and he talked to them about a particular place in Aruba when he was there 2 years prior. And the place is called Carlos and Charlie's. And there he talked to these parents. He told them about witnessing some locals trying to get a couple of his female classmates to leave with them. And he stepped in and stopped them from leaving. And he explained to the parents that he had believed that he stopped something dangerous from happening. So that he's warning the parents and having them to warn their students, their children as before they go on this class trip. So there's something to be aware of when you go to Aruba. So Beth talks about in this book about talking with Natalie about this. They talk about the fact that Natalie's 18, and in the States, you can't drink at age 18, but in Aruba, you can drink at 18. You can drink alcohol. So they talk about that, you know, you are going to be of legal drinking age. Don't sit your drink down. Don't, you know, leave it unattended. Don't be careful with what you do. Don't leave with anybody. They have all of these talks. So she said Beth says that Natalie was aware of this, and that Natalie had always been responsible. She had no reason to believe that there would be any issues. So on Thursday, May the 26th, 2005, they leave for this trip to Aruba. Now, Beth's job is to drop Natalie off at a friend's home early that morning. They're going, that friend's mom is going to take them to the airport. They're going to fly out. They're coming home on May the 30th. 2005 on Memorial Day Monday. And Beth is going to pick them up at the airport. So early morning, I don't know exactly the time, but early morning on Thursday, May 26th, she drops Natalie off. They go to the airport and they fly to Aruba. Natalie is going to not show up on Monday, May the 30th, 2005, in the hotel lobby. So every morning or at some point in time, there was a meet time that they would all meet, the students, the chaperones would kind of do a head count, and then they would go on about their merry way. On Monday, May 30th, Natalie did not show up. They were going to meet in the lobby, board buses, go to the airport, and fly home.
Right.
So she does not show up. Beth talks about getting this call, the call, in quotes, as she is traveling back from visiting her family in Hot Springs, Arkansas. So Beth's family has a lake home in this area of Arkansas. So they went for the long weekend, she and two of her friends. They, you know, just had a relaxing weekend.
Sure. Kid out of the house.
Yeah, my kid just graduated from high school. Let's all go celebrate.
We're going to enjoy ourselves, have some adult time at the lake house, and then pick them up on Monday. So they're driving home from staying at the lake house on the weekend, and she gets a call. And the call is from the travel agent's daughter. The travel agent's name is Jody. Her daughter is on the other end of the phone. When Beth picks up the phone, she says, "My mother needs to talk with you." Jody, the travel agent, gets on the line, and she says that Natalie didn't show up to get onto the flight back to the States. Her mother says at that point, she immediately knew. I'm having some mic. I think I'm sorry. My mic was doing flips.
I saw that.
It's really weird. I'm sorry.
Sorry. I wasn't sure if it was actually happening or if it was just me.
Yeah, just to let the listeners know, my mic was trying to flip on me there. I'm so sorry. So, Natalie doesn't show up, and her mother says, "There is something wrong immediately. This is not like my daughter. My daughter is not late. She is not even on time. She's always early."
Her father said the same thing in the book that I read. He knew immediately that something was wrong when Natalie wasn't where she was supposed to be when she was supposed to be there.
So she wasn't just hung over in a hotel room and, you know, her alarm didn't go off.
Correct. And her roommates are in the lobby and they're saying, well, she did not come to the room last night. They assumed that she stayed in another room because that tends to happen on senior trip. You may crash in one room one night, you may crash in another room another night. I don't want to get into a whole lot of details and tattle on everybody here on senior
trip. Yeah, anybody who's at least 19 years old who's ever been on a senior trip knows exactly what you're talking
about.
You know,
and they said she didn't come to the room. So her things are still in her room, including her wallet. So that's a big deal.
So and her passport.
She didn't run off.
Her passport was there. Correct. Very important things that an 18-year-old needs. Mm-hmm. So they know immediately. I was pretty amazed at how quickly her mom was on a flight to Aruba.
Yeah.
They were on a private jug. She goes through this in this book. I really recommend that you read this book. It's a really good book. But they go through the account of Jug knows someone who knows who has a plane, and she kind of walks you through how this happens and who ends up getting on the plane, and they are flying to Aruba. In the meantime, a few of the chaperones agree to stay, and they send all the kids home. Now, some of the kids wanted to stay because that's their friend.
Sure.
They didn't want to leave, but I'm 100% behind the chaperones in saying, these kids are getting out of here.
Get them home.
They're getting out of Aruba right now. So they get them out, and Beth and Jug come flying into Aruba. What the students say happened on the previous night is this. They were partying on their last night in Aruba at Carlos and Charlie's. Do you remember this?
Yes.
Carlos and Charlie's. We brought that up earlier. The former Mountain Brook student who had been on this trip warned of locals trying to pick up some of the female students in Carlos and Charlie's.
And possibly getting roofied if you're not attentive of your drink.
Yes. So they're partying at Carlos and Charlie's. They had actually been to Carlos and Charlie's several times on this trip. So they're there for the final night. And they say that Natalie left in a silver or a gray Honda with a young man who had befriended some of their classmates. Now, I have also heard some of the classmates interviewed and watched just short clips of their interviews. And one girl actually said the vehicle is white. Mm-hmm. But most of the accounts that I have read say silver or gray. That's the only time with the one interview that I actually heard a white vehicle. Did anyone else see?
It was silver or gray is what I read most of the time. Okay. I mean, and the car turned up later. I mean,
it was actually silver.
It belonged to one of the Calpo brothers.
Yeah.
So they found the car that was in question.
And it was a silverish vehicle.
Gray. Yeah.
So she gets into this silver vehicle with a young man who had befriended some of the classmates. Now, Jug's nephew, who's also on this trip, Thomas, says that he actually met the guy that Natalie was leaving with. He said he played poker with him, actually beside him, at the Excelsior Casino, which is located inside of the Holiday Inn, which is where the Mountain Brook group was staying. And the students, they're talking, they're like, man, what was his name? Was it like Jaron? Was it Jora? And then they say Joran. They discover that the student's name is Joran, and he is a tourist from Holland who is also staying at the Holiday Inn.
That's what he said.
That's what the students know. That's what Joran told them. They quickly learn that this guy's name is Joran Vandersloot. He is 17 years old. He goes to school in Aruba. He lives there. He does not stay at the Holiday Inn. And he is there with two of his friends, and you said they're the Calpo brothers.
K-A-L-P-O-E. I assume that's the correct pronunciation.
We're
going to call them Calpo. Somebody can let us know if we got it wrong.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. I'm probably not saying that correctly. But what were the Calpo brothers' first names? Because those were the trios, Joran, and then it was the two brothers that were
somebody's
going
to have to look that
together.
Up pretty quick, because
the older brother was 21.
Yes.
The younger brother was 19. Mm-hmm. And then Joran is 17.
Yeah. And they were friends who hung out together. And
Deepak is the oldest.
That's one.
And Satish.
Satish is the 19 year old.
Yeah. And they were friends who hung out together and spent time in those. They played Texas Hold'em poker was really big back then. In the mid-2000s, it had really blown up and gotten big all over the country. There's still poker tournaments on all the sports channels today, and all of that started back in the early 2003, 2004, 2005. So everybody was playing Texas Hold'em back in those days, and that was one of the reasons, or one of the ways I think that they may have met, was that they were all there together, and they started playing poker in the tournaments at the casinos, and all of these hotels had adjacent casinos.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting because Joran is 17 years old, so he's actually not old enough. You're supposed to be 18 to be able to be in the casinos and to party at some of these night spots. Now, I don't know how the laws work, and I don't know if you could be in there and just not, you're not supposed to be drinking. Like, you could get into Carlos and Charlie's under 18.
I understand, yeah.
And I don't know that, but I do believe that to play poker, you're supposed to be 18 years old. So I'm not sure how
I read one passage that describes the Sunday night in question at Carlos and Charlie's. Joran was so well known to the people who worked at Carlos and Charlie's that he had some sort of card or some sort of pass or some sort of nod and wink. He didn't even have to pay a cover charge when he went into Carlos and Charlie's. He was so well known there by the folks who worked there. So I can only assume that perhaps something similar happened when he's at the casino. Maybe just because he's a resident and he's there all of the time, and his father is an official.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I was getting at.
I'm sorry.
Is you learn that? No, I'm glad you went into that, because That's how he was able to do these things. Mm-hmm. His father, and I'm not, is it Paulus?
Well, I saw Paul. Let's just call him Paul, okay, Vandersloot, because, yeah, it is Paulus. But I noticed several times in the transcripts of the police investigations that I read in the Holloway files that a lot of times it was just shortened to Paul.
Okay. So Paul is somebody.
Yes.
He is a big name.
He's involved in the legal system, mm-hmm, on the island of Aruba.
He was a former judge?
And
is that right?
And from what I read, I think he was training to be a judge.
That's okay.
He was in the ranks to become a judge. He was an attorney, practicing attorney.
Like a lawyer, okay, who maybe has to take some sort of exam to be able to be declared a judge,
right,
on the island of Aruba.
I didn't do a whole lot of research into how all their legal system works, but
yeah. So he's a big name on the island of Aruba, and therefore his son gets to take some liberties.
Everybody in the police department, everybody that's law enforcement, knows who Paul Vandersloot is on the island of Aruba in May of 2005.
And the not the original guy who was over the police department when this happened, but the one who took over, had at one point in time worked under Paul. At one point in time, Paul was his boss,
there was
is the way that I understand
a lot of connections that people will spend years making accusations and pointing fingers, mm-hmm, and with a crooked eye and thinking, wait a minute, did this all happen? And I don't know that we'll ever know, mm-hmm, exactly how that played out, but it certainly lends itself to, mm-hmm, somebody got special treatment and
mm-hmm. Well, and regardless of what happened afterwards, I mean, the bottom line, in my opinion at this point, is Jorn had no business being in any of these places. He was not old enough. He shouldn't,
exactly,
have been there, mm-hmm, in the first place. So it's interesting to think about, had those rules been enforced, where we would be today. Would we even be talking about this? And I'll just kind of tell you, I don't think we would be.
Possibly.
And so, anyways, that's my two cents there. And so, Scott, I'm going to, pass the buck over to you.
Oh, is it my turn?
It's your turn. I'm done.
Okay, so I mean, we'll go through kind of what and it's really hard to understand exactly what happened because there's so many differing accounts and I'll just use his first name just so we don't confuse him with his father. Jorn tells so many different stories after he comes under police scrutiny about exactly what it was that took place that it's impossible to piece this thing all together with any certainty because it's changed so many times. But a couple of days before, or maybe the night before, Natalie and some of her friends were in the casino and they settled down at a blackjack table, I think it was, and Jorn Vandersloot was there gambling. And so they all played together on the poker table or on the blackjack table and got to know each other. And then it was the next night that they were all going to go to Carlos and Charlie's for their last night. And there was a sequence where Natalie supposedly asks Jorn to go and join them. And he says, well, nobody really goes out on Sunday night. And it was Sunday night, May the 30th in Aruba. But he showed up anyway. And there's differing accounts of exactly what happens after they all get there. I'm not going to go into the details, but whatever you think might happen in a tropical Caribbean island where there is alcohol and dancing and loud music. I mean, it's one of those nights.
He talks about doing body shots and
body shots.
And the classmate of Natalie's that I had recently or mentioned before that I'd watched the video, she admits that Jorn did a couple of body shots and Beth talks about it in the book that apparently that happened.
I mean, it was nuts. It was legal. I mean, everybody was nobody was breaking the law except for Jorn Vandersloot.
Jorn was too young to be drinking.
When he was 17.
He shouldn't have been doing body shots, and he shouldn't have been ordering them a drink. He claims that he ordered a drink after doing the shots, and it was rum, like 151, a really strong.
Yeah, it was Bacardi 151
rum.
And Diet Cola, which they called Red Heat or Red Shots, or it was just whatever. It was just a name that they had for Bacardi and Diet. It was just a way to,
but a very strong
to market
Bacardi.
The drink. Yes,
a stronger Bacardi.
Yeah,
and
well, 151 you can light on fire.
Yeah, that's like 75% alcohol.
They put it on top of drinks, and you light it on fire as a party trick.
Right.
So there you go. That may be why it was called that.
Ex bartender Katie Gibbons knows that. She's not a lawyer, but she used to be
a bartender.
But anyway, so what we know happens for sure is that at some point when the bar closes down at 1 a.m., Natalie goes outside with Joran Vandersloot and climbs into the car with the Calpo brothers. Tell me their names one more time.
Deepak and Satish.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Climbs into the car. So the four of them leave. And at one point, her window is down and she yells to a friend of hers, Aruba, like, hey, we're having fun and I'm leaving. And I'll see you guys back at the hotel tomorrow.
Her, she's saying, I'm getting a ride back to the hotel. And she yells, Aruba. As she's
and that's the
driving
last,
off.
Mm-hmm. And that's the last time her friends ever see her alive.
Yep. When I was on senior trip, we would have yelled YOLO. That was the that so I guess that was their phrase of choice. That
what
was.
Does that mean?
Oh wow, Scott, you're showing
your
age.
Am I too
old
to know what that means?
You only live once.
Ah,
YOLO.
Okay, I have heard that before. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm sorry. Anyway, so yeah, something similar to that. But right after that, right after they pull out of the parking lot, now that's where the confusion. That's where nobody knows what happens, and all we have to go on is what Joran Vandersloot said on three or four different occasions, what the Calpo brothers said. They were all hauled in. Well, actually, they weren't the first people. Let me think how to tell this story so that it makes a little bit of sense. They tell the story when Natalie doesn't show up and folks start making phone calls and trying to find out exactly what happened. They're the first two people who are arrested are two security guards at the Holiday Inn, because their story is, the Calpo brothers and Vandersloot's story is that they drive around for a while, go to a couple of different places, the California Lighthouse, which is on the northernmost point of the island of Aruba, because Natalie supposedly wanted to see the sharks, even though there aren't any sharks in those waters. At some point, maybe they got dropped off at the fishermen's huts that are on the beach. They're close to the resort, to the line of resorts. The Marriott is there, and then the Holiday Inn is right down from it, and I don't think it's the Holiday Inn anymore. I couldn't find it on Google Maps the other day. But so there's really some confusion about exactly when Natalie supposedly parted ways or got out of that car to stay. But the first story that the three boys told was that they dropped her off at the Holiday Inn and she stumbled out of the car and fell, and Joran tried to help her up and she refused his help. And as they drove away, they saw two black security guards dressed in black uniforms trying to help her up and get her into the lobby. And so it wasn't very long, maybe a day or so before those two or before two black security guards were called in for questioning. And one of the ways that the Dutch system of law works that is different from ours is you can bring someone in and hold them in a jail cell for days, as long as you think that there is a reason to hold them. But then after 7 days or 10 days, a judge gets involved and looks at all of the evidence that has been compiled so far and decides whether or not you can continue to hold them or if they have to be let go because there's not enough evidence for them to remain in jail. So those two security guards don't stay incarcerated for very long.
No, because they're going to view the footage.
There is security footage from the Holiday Inn, and there's some discrepancy about I've read a passage where it says that Beth Twitty, mm-hmm. Claims on one of the national TV shows, Nancy Grace or one of the others, that there was no security footage because the cameras were broken. But I've also
that's the first story she heard.
Okay,
she first heard that the footage was gone. They get the Twitties get a really good lawyer involved, mm-hmm. there on the island.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, we have some footage.
And all of a sudden, we have security footage.
We have some footage. Okay. And guess who's not on that footage?
Natalie never walked back in through that lobby.
She never walked back into the Holiday Inn.
To go back to her room that night.
No. And so then the story's going to change that he left her on the beach.
Right. And there's eventually, and I don't know exactly, and Kelly, help me out here. I don't know when this happened, but at some point, the Twitties, Natalie Holloway's mother and stepfather, mm-hmm. go to the Vandersloot home.
Yes. And, pretty quickly.
Yeah,
and,
that's
and
pretty
confront
immediate.
Him. I mean, that's as soon as they get there, they're like, hey, we found out you're
they
the last person to see our daughter.
They go from a casino to back to the Holiday Inn, back to the casino. Then they're at the Vandersloot home, and they confront Paul, and Paul is trying to get Joran on the phone, and Paul is
Paul is Joran's father.
He is. He is. He's calling Joran and he's saying he's coming home. I mean, he's even calling him at the time. He's supposed to be gambling at the time. when they went and saw him. And so, I mean, again, I don't know.
So whatever happened.
If we're dealing with an age thing there. Like, yeah. Why is your 17-year-old at the casino?
Right. But there was a confrontation at the Vandersloot home.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't too long after that before the Calpo brothers and Joran were brought in for questioning.
Yes. There was a gardener who claimed to see them in the vehicle early that morning, in the morning in question.
In a place that they didn't mention that they had been to.
And they were acting very strange and suspicious. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're arrested on June 9th, and all this started on May 30th.
Okay, so 10 days later, they've been hauled in, and then we start this process of...
And that's when we get all these different stories.
Right. Mm-hmm. The first story, it seems like maybe they had all kind of gotten together, and they all had a story that had some ridiculous similarities. I mean, supposedly there was a conversation with Natalie in the car where she asked, Joran Vandersloot, are these two dark-skinned people your slaves? Because back in Alabama, I would live on a plantation and they would be slaves. It just sounds like a ridiculous story that somebody who didn't know very much about Alabama, this was the first thing I thought. Mm-hmm. They've heard of Alabama. Mm-hmm. They know about the Civil War. That story sounds completely made up to me.
I can't imagine Natalie
Holloway or anybody else
like
would
that.
Say something ridiculous like that. But they all three told the same story in different ways. And one of the cool things about the Holloway files is that a lot of that book is transcripts from interviews. And there are multiple interviews with all three of these suspects. And you can see the story. And I almost got to the point where it was so confusing that I wanted to stop reading it because I was forgetting exactly what the timeline was and when they changed their stories. But over and over and over, as they got caught in a lie, the story would change. And Vandersloot, much more so than the Calpo brothers, they kind of stuck to their story because once they got separated, there was no way for them to all get together anymore and make sure that their stories meshed like the first one had.
So the Calpo brothers, their stories remained so clear that they were actually released before Joran.
Yeah.
They ended up being released and then rearrested, and then they were all released again at the same time.
Yeah.
Joran for the first time.
Right. Going back a little bit before they were arrested, the investigator was really slow. In the Holloway's opinion, I can understand that. I can see.
Sure.
You have to follow your law.
Yeah, I mean, they got to Aruba with their hair on fire.
Yeah, they wanted
my daughter's
something done
missing
immediately. And no judgment here.
Sure.
But there was, the investigator was not in a hurry because he kept saying, she'll turn up on the beach. She'll turn up on the beach. And so what they learned is that something that happens or that was happening at the time in Aruba, I can't speak for 2021.
Yeah.
But in 2005, what was happening in Aruba is some of the locals would party with some of the tourists and they would learn, oh, their last day is tonight or tomorrow.
Exactly.
And what they would do on their last night, they would rob them. They'd end up at a crack house or, you know, they would take them there. They would rob them. They would, you know, drug them, leave them on the beach. And when the tourist wakes up, it's their travel day.
Yeah. So oh, shit, I got
to
go.
They're not wanting to stay in Aruba and report a crime. They're wanting to get the heck out of there.
Yeah.
So they get on a plane and leave. So that was kind of the way that it worked on a lot of tourists' final nights there. And this was such a common occurrence that the investigator kept saying, she'll turn up on the beach.
Yeah.
She's on the beach.
And if you don't know where Aruba is, and I had to look it up to see, I knew it was somewhere out there in the South Atlantic, but it is literally 17 miles from the coast of South America. So Colombia, the cocaine capital of the world to this day, I'm sure, is right there. There's marijuana is readily available. Any kind of drug that you want. So the port system is really lax in the island of Aruba, and it's very easy to transport things and just say that it's a box of TVs. Nobody's going to check and see what it is because the laws are so lax there. So
drug smuggling's easy.
The drug smuggling is very easy. So there's plenty of drugs that don't ever get off the island of Aruba on their way to somewhere else. They get pilfered and somebody gets to use some of those. And so that's out and about and being circulated in the community, and the law enforcement at the time knew it. It was kind of this gentleman's agreement. Hey, you don't do it right in front of me and I won't have to arrest you. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of that going on in Aruba. And maybe to this day, if it's, is it still a popular senior trip destination?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
I know that tourism for sure took a hit, and I think it has rebounded some, and that's probably why you couldn't find the Holiday Inn. I'm sure they rebranded.
I'll bet they did. And the Carlos and Charlie's has since been rebranded as Senior Frogs, and I found out that the same company owns both of them. So I guess it's like if Carlos and Charlie's gets a bad name, we'll just come in and paint everything green and call it Senior Frogs.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what has happened in Aruba since then with Carlos and Charlie's.
When the tourism started really taking a hit is when you started seeing a lot of the very public backlash from the Aruban officials and then the Holloways. You're going to see that happen very publicly.
Yeah.
And they're going to make the Holloways look bad. The Holloways are making, they're wanting to make them look bad. So it becomes really nasty in the media.
Well, and the Holloways even got, Bob Riley was the governor of the state of Alabama at the time, and they got him involved in a push to try and boycott
tourism
on the island of Aruba. And Richard Shelby, who was our senior senator and still is here in the state of Alabama, he got involved in it and made a statement. And I think the governors of Georgia and maybe either Tennessee or Arkansas also got on board. It didn't really take off the way the Holloways had hoped that it might, but there was still this push to, hey, your kids aren't safe. If you send them to Aruba, well, don't let them go on their senior trip there because these things happen, date rape and roofies and bad stuff.
It really probably hurt a lot of senior trips and a lot of tourism, a lot of places. I know Celeste, one of our loyal listeners and always is at the live show, she was telling me that she was, I think she said 16 at the time that this happened, and her parents did not let her go on a senior trip right after this.
Shutdown on Aruba after that, right?
Well, and it was a shutdown on just going on a senior trip. In general.
I don't know if she was going to Aruba, but she said her parents were like, no, you're not going to be another Natalie Holloway.
Yeah. Hello, Celeste.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening,
yeah,
Celeste.
Absolutely.
So one of the first things and the probably the most sickening things that the Holloways had to endure when they get to the island is they're working on this theory that she's going to turn up on the beach, that she might be in one of the crack houses, one of the prostitution houses, I mean, whatever they called it there. Oh, they had a word and I just completely went blank on what they called it, but it was like a house of prostitution for lack of, I can't think of what their word was.
A brothel?
No, but it's what they called it in Aruba.
It's their own little term. Gotcha.
Yes. So, anyways, they have to go in the middle of the night and walk through these crack houses and dens of iniquity looking for Natalie. And the things that they see there are very devastating, especially when you're looking for your 18-year-old daughter.
Yeah, but I mean, I get...
When you're from, an affluent neighborhood like Mountain Brook that you've never seen.
Yeah, and we didn't mention that.
Crack house with hidden walls, and behind the walls there are chairs with barbed wire on them, so it's very obvious people are kept there against their will, and they're looking at people who are passed out on the floor and people who are just, and they're not finding Natalie. They don't find her in any of these.
Well, and I don't have any children, but I can only imagine when you're down to, you have two choices, either she's dead or she's alive. Mm-hmm.
Which is scarier, honestly, in this situation. Yeah, I mean,
you're willing to look anywhere to find her alive at that point, because the alternative is she's never coming home again.
Yeah. And you're thinking, if she is alive, what is happening to her?
I don't care what kind of shape she's in. We'll get her home. But exactly. It's still got
to
be devastating.
It's still just gut-wrenching. And so they have to go through these, and they have to do this. It's not like you can go through the crack house after lunch. They're having to go through in the middle of the night. They're having to have these secret meetings. They're not finding her anywhere. So then they arrest the guys. They bring them in. They're interviewing them. Their stories are changing. They get released. And then they get rearrested.
Yeah, the brothers do. Joran stays in custody this entire time from like June to September.
Yeah, they hold him as long as they can. I mean, the judge, they keep going back to the judge every, Katie, tell me 10 days or 15 days or whatever it is. But every so often they have to go back to the judge and be able to justify his continued containment.
Incarceration.
Thank you. That's the word.
When he is released, they put a travel restriction on him and say he has to stay in a territory of the Netherlands. And so he heads actually
But he went back to the Netherlands, right?
For school. And then soon after that, a court removed his travel restriction. So he was able to go wherever he pleased. But
and that was the first time. And we'll get, I'm assuming we'll get to the second time he was arrested. But that was the first time.
That was the first time. And then the brothers were rearrested. Yeah. And then they were released. Mm-hmm. Everybody was released right after Hurricane Katrina hit. Yes.
So September 3rd.
A lot of people think that this was a way for the officials to sneak this under the...
Sure.
I mean, it was a media frenzy there in Aruba. There were people from all over the world there. There were people... Celebrities were getting involved. People, pro football players. Brett Favre had gotten wind that Yoren was a big fan of his and was actually going to be involved in trying to get him to talk and tell
really
what happened. And then the way that it was put in the book was there was some managerial things and he didn't get to come, or I'm paraphrasing, or I'm not quoting exactly, but I kind of took it as either, no, you don't have time to not play pro football and go do this, or no, you're not doing this at all.
Or no, you're not doing this. I appreciate the gesture.
This is a terrible idea, and you're just going to stick to football.
Yeah.
But he did offer some financial support, and so did David Arquette and Courtney Cox. Courtney Cox is a former Mountain Brook student.
That's right.
So they offered some financial help. The people of Aruba were very sympathetic to the Holloways, to the Twitties in the Holloways that were there. They would do prayer chains every night. I mean, in the book, she talks about these prayer chains that go, just on and on and on down the road, where the locals were, their hearts were going out to them. They were welcomed by the locals. The locals helped them pray. She got into a cab one night. She talks about not knowing where to go, what to do. She needed to go to a church. Well, the cab driver took her to a place where they had all of these different crosses, and it was kind of like the journey of Christ as he walked to the hill.
Okay.
And she stopped at every cross and prayed, and the cab driver waited patiently on her, helped her get back into the car, helped her, and drove home. And the people there were very, very supportive and very sympathetic and wanted there to be change. Now, this is going to change when they release the brothers. Mm. This first time they released the brothers, right?
Yes.
I think so.
The first time they released the brothers.
I don't know that they were ever rearrested.
Yes, they are.
They were? Okay.
So they're going to be released, and she is going to make a very public statement saying, we cannot allow these criminals to walk the street. And immediately, her sympathy from the people of Aruba is gone. They do not like that. These brothers were released. They do not view them as criminals.
Yeah, our legal system has determined that they have there's no reason to hold them. So if you believe in the law, you're accusing two innocent people of being criminals.
And that does not fly with the locals. And so then as that starts to change, Beth Holloway is going to make a public apology. Mm-hmm. Too little, too late. They're not going to forgive her for that. And it's going to start changing, and then the officials are going to start firing back because of the tourism hit that they have taken.
It's killing. Mm-hmm. It's killing them.
And they're going to...
Tourism is their biggest industry.
Yes.
And 75% of the people who go to Aruba or went to Aruba at the time on vacation were from the United States of America.
Yes.
I could say that.
Yes. And so they're gonna that's gonna quickly turn, and then that's when you're gonna start hearing these stories of what a partier Natalie was, and they're gonna start making her look pretty bad.
Yeah,
which is I'm just gonna leave that where that is.
Yeah.
That's
pretty pathetic. But also Beth has to endure all these different story changes. Beth and Dave, they have to endure all these story changes from Yoren and the details that he talks about, because he's going to talk about some sexual activity with her, and he's going to talk about how she's going in and out of consciousness when this is happening. And I mean, they're just, They're sickened by what they have to listen to.
Yeah.
And in this book, Beth finds herself at, I believe it's kind of like a coffee shop. And one of the brothers who's been released is working there.
Wow.
She goes up to him while he's stalking around. I have no idea exactly how to picture this, but around the counter, it's just the two of them. And she says, she very calmly says things to him that Yoren had been talking about. Like, you know what color her underwear was, don't you? You know they were they were this color, and you know that Yoren did this, and you know that this happened, and you know, and she's talking about how she's saying it very calmly and how he doesn't, she's wanting a reaction out of him, and he gets really stiff, and then he kind of just turns and walks away, and then she's later asked to never come back to the to the coffee shop.
Well, she knew that that was going to be her last trip ever in that coffee shop when she walked to, up to him to start that conversation.
She did. She also went with Greta Van Zestren back to the home of Yoren Vandersloot and confronted Paul. And she is actually invited into the home and talks with both parents. And she talks about that meeting in the book, and nothing really comes of it, but she recant. She tells that story, and it's so.
Was it therapeutic for her at all? Did she get any satisfaction out of doing
that? I think that she did, and I think that she was able to not have a hate for these people. They're it was almost like they were no longer the big bad villains. I mean, I wouldn't say they'll ever be friends, but the mother has, Yoren's mother has publicly stated that he's a bad kid. He's a bad child.
That he has mental issues.
And that he doesn't mind. He's a, she has been, she has made it very clear many times that he's a bad apple.
Well, that seems to be a refrain that we find ourselves singing on this show a lot. A lot of the people that we end up talking about are not, most of them aren't rational human beings in some way, shape, or form. And it sometimes it manifests itself in the most egregious of crimes possible. And I'm not accusing Yoren Vandersloot of murdering Natalie Holloway. We'll never know that unless he admits it. And if he admitted it tomorrow, I wouldn't believe him necessarily anyway, because he's changed his story so many times.
He has admitted it, and there's been video of
that.
And then he retracts it all. He says, no, that I really didn't. It's kind of like a game.
Yeah. So we'll never know, but it seems like a lot of the people that we end up talking about on the show have these issues where they're just, everybody goes, oh, I knew he was going to snap. It was just a matter of time.
That's a commonality that you you do hear. I mean, we all have individuals that we went to school with, or that we've been around, or that we have worked with,
or that we bumped into over the weekend.
And if somebody said that person committed a crime, you know, fill in the blank, you might find yourself going, huh,
I could say that.
Sounds about right.
Not really shocked.
Yep.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Well, and I don't think that the mom was very shocked at all that Yoren was finding himself in this hot water for a time.
Because later on, she even says that she was going to have him committed. And before she could, he took off and left her a note just saying, I'm gone, don't worry. Do we want to talk a little bit about Yoren and what's happened to him later on?
Go for it.
So like we mentioned, he was arrested and then he was released. And then in 2007, which is 2 years after all of this was taking place to begin with, in 2005, he decides to publish a book with a reporter kind of giving his account of the story. And I didn't give that book a look over or even Google anything.
I'd say we don't even say the name of it. I don't want anybody to go buy it.
I don't know it. I didn't write it down.
No, I'm not going to give any money to that.
Yeah. So after this, and they say this had nothing to do with the book, but there was a new search of his parents' house conducted in April of 2007. And then in November of 2007, Yoren is rearrested along with the Calpo brothers for suspicion. The quote is for suspicion of involvement in voluntary manslaughter and causing serious bodily harm that resulted in the death of Natalie Holloway.
Is this after the Dutch police got involved and went back and investigated it again.
Because
the first investigation was by the Aruban authorities. Mm-hmm. Nothing came of it. So there's still this uproar, right?
Yeah.
Katie, 2 years later. So the Dutch go, all right, we've got to get involved and come up with a report about what happened.
Yeah. They say because of new incriminating evidence, and they don't specify as to what that is. So 2 days after this, Vandersloot is returned to Aruba because he is arrested in the Netherlands where he is, where he was residing and going to school. So 2 days later, he's returned to Aruba. A few days later, there's a court hearing that said that they're going to hold him for 8 days.
Okay.
And on December 7th, which was actually a little longer than the 8 days, he is released without any charges. They can't find anything else. No, they can't get any.
That's the second and final time, right, that he was arrested.
For this crime. Years later, in 2010, he goes on to go a little nuts. He gets in contact with the Holloway's attorney that they have in the U.S., which his name was John Q. Kelly. So they get in touch, and Jorn's telling him, hey, I'll tell you what happened. I'll tell you where Natalie's body is, and I'll tell you what happened to her. I want $25,000 in advance, and then after I tell you, I want $250,000 total.
So, extortion.
Yeah. So, Kelly goes to Aruba, and Joran is so hard up for money that Kelly's like, hey, you know, if you'll start talking a little bit, I'll give you $100. And Joran's like, all right. So, he takes $100 from him.
Okay.
Kelly immediately, obviously, notifies the FBI, and they set up.
We're talking about Natalie's mother, right?
No, Kelly is the attorney.
Kelly is the attorney.
Oh, the attorney goes.
John Q. Kelly.
I'm sorry.
So, last name Kelly is what I'm referring to him as. Kelly sets up, he notifies the FBI, and they set up a sting operation with the Aruban authorities, and he goes for more money, so they send him a wire transfer of $15,000 to one account in the Netherlands, and then he gets another $10,000 in cash, and that interaction is taped by an undercover authority in Aruba, and he tells them that his father helped him bury her remains in a foundation of a home that they were building.
Now, is he telling this after his father passed away? Because Paul is going to pass away very suddenly.
So it's easy to shift the blame to dad if dad's not around to defend
that was a very, very key point in this.
Dad drops dead of a heart attack while playing tennis.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and it was a very fishy kind of death. I think it's probably because if you take away all of this, no one's going to suspect anything when just things happen. I mean, unfortunate things happen, but there was a little bit of rumors around that this was a very suspicious death.
This was after his father.
So after his father passes away, he's willing to talk for any kind of money that he can get, and he's willing to blame it on his father.
Yes.
But just to clear this up and to make sure that I'm not mistaken about what Katie's talking about, doesn't it turn out that the house
wasn't even built then.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. House was not built. He emails Kelly telling him, yeah, I lied about all of that. Charges were not immediately filed, and he flees to Columbia with this money. Then the U.S. District Court of Northern Alabama charges him with extortion and wire fraud.
Okay.
And they issue an arrest warrant, but they have to do it through Interpol because, they want him prosecuted in the U.S., but he's not in the U.S., and that's a whole ordeal. About a month later, he's formally indicted, and they seek for the forfeiture of all that money that was paid to him, and they want him extradited to the U.S. so they can try him on these crimes.
Okay.
But this is all happening at the same time. On May 10th is when the wire transfer is made.
Okay.
What year are we in, Katie?
We're in 2010, sorry.
2010.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So a very pivotal year in the future of Joran Vandersloot.
We're in 2010. I'll run back through a little timeline. Yeah. March is when he contacts Attorney Kelly.
All right.
May is when the wire transfer happens. April is when Kelly goes and meets him, gives him the $100. May is when they set up the sting operation. The wire transfers happen. Then in June is when he is charged with and then formally indicted. But
Can I say something really quick, Katie? When you were running back through your timeline, you said March is when he contacted.
Yes.
Okay, his father passed away on February 10th, 2010.
So a month before he decides to...
A month after the death of his father, he's contacting them.
He's literally going to give up the ghost, and it's his dead father, the ghost, as he's giving up.
Gotcha. Yep. Okay, that's perfect timing then. Yes. So May 10th, when the wire transfers happen, in June is when the charges are going to be brought forth in the U.S., but on May 30th, 2010, it turns out that is 5 years to the day of when Natalie disappeared. A woman by the name of Stephanie Flores Ramirez is murdered in Lima, Peru.
Who murdered her, Katie?
Well, her body was found in a hotel room that was rented out by none other than Joran van der Sloot.
Interesting.
And he is not in Peru anymore, because he has fled to Chile, where he is arrested and extradited back to Peru for questioning. And then on June 7th, just, 8 days later, he confesses. She was beat to death, so he confesses.
She was beaten to death with a tennis racket.
Yeah. So he confesses. He later tries to formally retract this confession. He claims that he was intimidated by the Peruvian police, but the Peruvian judge said no. That your confession is valid.
It would seem the Peruvians are not going to care that he's a van der Sloot.
Nope.
Nor
exactly
all of those things that were offered to him in Aruba. The Peruvians are like, we don't care. You're just you're just another person, we don't believe that you're retracting your. Yeah, we don't believe it.
All of the benefit of the doubt that he got in his home country, in his hometown, with his father potentially being able to pull strings, allegedly, not in Peru.
No. Right. So simultaneously, while he is confessing and being charged in Peru, the United States is levying these charges for the wire fraud and the extortion. So that's all happening at the exact same time. Peruvian judge says that his confession is valid, and then it takes 2 years for him to go through the court system in Peru. But on almost 2 years, anyway, a year and a half. On January 13th, 2012, he is sentenced to 28 years in prison for the murder of Stephanie Ramirez.
And I'll bet you if he ever gets out, the folks in Alabama are going to be glad to bring him to a federal courthouse in Birmingham and officially throw those extortion and wire fraud charges on him.
The Peruvian judge announced on March 9th, 2014, that he would face extradition to the U.S. in the year 2038, which is in 17 years.
So they're going to keep him. And then when they're finished, they're going to say, here you go, America.
So when we have year 18 of True Crime on Easy Street and we're still on the air, one of the things that we will be discussing is an update of this case. Okay.
On Joran van der Sloot's status.
Which it is crazy at how their system works, but only 28 years for murder.
For murder.
But in February of 2016, there was another undercover reporter who filmed him confessing to Natalie's murder again.
Right. His story had changed.
Yep. And he's speaking in Dutch and he's laughing. And apparently he has a Peruvian wife.
Yeah, he does now. Now and they have a daughter. Irony of ironies.
Is this a daughter that was conceived while he's been in prison?
Yes, that is correct.
They must have conjugal visits.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't look into the...
I stumbled across that at 2 o'clock this afternoon. I was just going through YouTube watching videos about the Holloways and the van der Sloot and the whole, just whatever I could find. And there was one mention of the fact that he has since
walked down the aisle. I hope that this daughter has a wonderful life. And
I do too.
Never has to deal with the pain and the backlash of how horrible her father. But for the Holloways, since then, Beth Holloway, we keep referring to her as Beth Holloway because her marriage to Jug eventually ended.
Okay.
I'm not passing any judgment here. I mean, they went through a tragedy and it did not survive it. And she's very upfront about it in the very beginning of the book that this whole incident did cost her a marriage.
Yeah.
And so she's gone back to using Holloway as her last name. And Beth Holloway still is looking for Natalie today. I really recommend reading this book, Loving Natalie.
I'm going to read it.
Loving Natalie by Beth Holloway, told from a mother's point of view. It is unbelievable how strong people can be. And it's the book doesn't leave you feeling sad. That's what's so incredible about it, is Beth Holloway is going to continue to talk with you about hope and about how she'll be helpful in this area and it'll dissolve, and then there'll be new reasons to have hope, and there'll be new reasons. And that is the central theme of this book. And I'm just going to tell you, I knew this story. Right. I knew what happened
right.
to Natalie Holloway. And I knew going into this book that we still do not know to this day what happened to Natalie Holloway. Yet every break, every new lead that they got in that book, I actually found myself feeling
hoping
the hope.
Really?
It was a really incredible experience to read this book, and I highly recommend it. And it was really amazing for me to go, Kelly, you know this. Mm-hmm. You know this.
Right.
You know there's nothing that's going to come of this. But it was like, oh, here's something new, and you're just wanting more. You're wanting this to happen for her. And I truly hope that someday this family can get some kind of closure. As each year ticks by, you know,
and
it's
think,
just hard to think that it's going to happen.
One of the things, speaking of hope, I, if I'm not mistaken, Mom has created a, I don't know if it's called the Natalie Holloway Foundation, but it's to help people who, to help families who are dealing with a child that's been kidnapped or is missing. And I'm not exactly sure about the details, but.
She's created that. She's also created another and I don't know the name of it, but we can, you know, it's a quick Google, and you guys can,
sure.
you can look that up, and it's interesting to see what comes out of tragedies like this. And one of the things is, for international travel for you to be able to understand the laws of a country, how everything works before you go. But that's just general good practice. If you're going to travel, mm-hmm. if you're going to go from state to state, you should probably know.
That's a good point. It mm-hmm. really is, because it's a little bit different everywhere. And the further away from home you go, I mean, let's just assume you load up and go to Cancun in 3 weeks, and some crime happens to you there, or you're accused of a crime.
It's going to be very different.
You're going to be in a lot of trouble and not know how to get yourself out of it.
We've mm-hmm. had friends who have been arrested in New Jersey because they had a gun there that they had no idea. You cannot have a firearm in New Jersey. Mm. And even though it's registered to them, and, you know, it's 1,000% legal in Alabama, and, you know, and then Shane has to be like, I don't practice law in New Jersey. I cannot help you.
Because lawyers have to have, they have to have a licensure for each mm-hmm. state. So. Mm-hmm. That's
which is
the way that
which
works.
Proves how crazy our legal system is here, because every state is so different that you mm-hmm. literally have to be licensed.
Well, you can't be a doctor in every state.
Right.
You have to get the licensure. Mm-hmm.
You can't be a doctor in this state. I know that.
I can't be a doctor any time. But if I were, I would have to be very specific about which states I want to practice in,
right.
and you have to pay the piper. You have to pay for those licensures,
mm-hmm.
and the state. You know, they're going to get their part of that in to recognize you as someone practicing like that. But if you're going international, you definitely need to know. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying this harping on the Holloways.
Certainly.
The Holloways are harping on this. They're saying,
because yes, it's the Natalie Holloway Resource Center, which is a web-based center for education and crime
awesome.
Prevention.
Mm-hmm. How many times has she saved our asses with her laptop?
With her young Google abilities.
Yeah, she's so good at that.
It's crimemuseum.org.
We're over here making stuff up, trying to remember it. And she's like, you know what? Why don't I just Google
I'll
it?
Just Google it while
there
they're
it is.
Yapping.
There it is, you dingbats.
But yeah, so there's also other things that she's working on, and it has to do with international laws and international travel and what you need to know, and mm-hmm. Trying to get some different things done and different laws passed, and Beth is just tireless.
So
she just works tirelessly.
Did we wrap this up good enough? Let's just assume that there's someone out there who was not familiar with the Natalie Holloway story before they turned on this podcast today.
We wrapped it up as much as it can be wrapped up.
Yeah, there's no,
she went to Aruba on a class trip. She left with these three guys. She's never been seen again.
There's three or four different scenarios about what might have happened. At some point, there was a boat involved. Maybe her body was taken out into the ocean and dumped. Maybe she was buried somewhere. Maybe she was sold into sex slavery because later on, Vandersloot does the same. I mean, he has said all of these things at various points since the crime took place or since the disappearance took place. Certainly, there was a crime somewhere because there's a lovely little 18-year-old girl who never came back to Alabama.
There's no body.
Yeah.
There's no body. And then you fast forward.
That's what, you know, and that is another report, that's what his dad said. Is what he said his dad said anyway. Correct. No body, no crime.
Yep, allegedly.
And you fast forward to 2010, and we do have a body. And the body of a lovely young woman who was murdered.
Yeah.
Brutally by Jorn Vandersloot.
Yeah.
And Natalie was formally declared dead in January of 2012, which coincided with his sentencing to prison with same month, same year.
Well, and I feel like this is the Holloways have to take this. I can't imagine. They have to take this as some backhanded form of justice for them, right. I guess. I can't get in there. Psyche in their head, and I want them to get justice for them.
Yeah,
but at least he is off the street.
At least he's not walking around.
And it's sad that another young woman had to pay a price we don't know if Natalie paid or not, but
yeah,
yep.
Yeah, if there's ever anything that we can update about this case, certainly we will do it in the future.
I surely hope that there's one day where we turn on these mics and we say,
me too.
Awesome. Here's some wonderful news in the Natalie Holloway case.
Yeah.
But I think some light is the fact that he's incarcerated and he's there for a while.
He won't ever be free to go anywhere again. I mean, 2038, Alabama still wants him. If he walks out of that Peruvian prison, we're still going to want him.
They're still going to want him.
So,
and now I don't know what the sentencing is for extortion and wire fraud. You know, it's not the same as a murder sentence, right. But it is something.
Well,
it's something
as long
while
as he's off
the
street.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I guess we wrapped up another one.
I wish we could have tied this up in a bow, but unfortunately, that's the nature of this case. Yeah. We don't know what happened to Natalie, and gosh, we may never know. I hope we do at some point.
All right. Somebody talk about social media. I'm always confused about that.
Well, just don't forget to like, rate, subscribe, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify if that's where you're at. Come see us on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook, and we will be live
every other Wednesday.
Now, last
we don't know
week,
what date it is.
Last week, I said that it was that Wednesday. I was off on my recordings. The Wednesday that this one drops, though, we will be live.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Oh, yeah, that's true. So that'll be the 18th of September. Is that correct?
If you're wondering, come find us on Instagram or Facebook, and we will have it posted.
We'll tell you.
We will let you know. We will let you know. You can always call Easy Street.
Or you can come have lunch or dinner at Easy Street Restaurant, Bar, and Performance Hall, and there are TV screens that will show you when we are going to be live again.
Exactly. So that's probably better than trying to follow. Yeah. We record early, and so we get confused a little bit on our days. So please bear with us. Thank you for loving us.
Yeah. If you're following us on social media, we don't post those early.
Yep. And please email us at truecrimeoneasystreet@gmail.com with a case idea, general thoughts. Leave us a 5-star rating.
But no
complaints. Write a review. Please write a review.
Yeah, good reviews.
Leave your complaints at home and don't type them in an email. We don't.
Nope. That is not productive.
Care. Right in the garbage can. File 13 on any complaints.
Do we have, guys, I mean, I've not even checked. Do we have any shout outs or do we have?
We got Celeste
anything?
Earlier.
So. We got Celeste. Yeah, again, thank you so much, Celeste. Okay, I'm just going to check really quick. Everybody bear with me.
She's really good with her social media despite
this is the musical
the fact that we
part.
Turned
I mean,
over to Katie.
I know. Anyways, I think it's just Celeste for this week, but wow, that's not just Celeste. Thank you.
Yeah, Celeste and three other people. Good night, everybody.